Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So we begin today by giving you a choice. You can switch over to AM 820 and hear the Alito hearings live and in full, or stay with us here on 93.9, and here's what we'll do. We will also devote the entire show this morning, the next 2 hours, to the Alito hearings. But right now, Senator Sam Brownback, Republican from Kansas, is beginning his half hour of questioning of Judge Alito for the first round. And experience from yesterday shows that all the Republican questioning has not really been questioning. It's been softballs. It's been advocating for him. And so we think that that's less interesting and likely to be, again, in Sam Brownback's case, than focusing on the confrontations between Judge Alito and the Democrats. And you can decide for yourself who's got the upper hand, Alito or the Democratic senators who are grilling him. But again, if you want to hear Senator Brownback's questioning live, we're doing that on AM 820 right now. But we're going to focus on perhaps the highlight of yesterday's testimony, which, as I said before the news, came during New York Senator Chuck Schumer's questioning at 6 o'clock after all the TV networks except C-SPAN had cut away. And if you were listening on AM 820, even AM 820 goes to low power after sunset, so maybe a lot of you couldn't hear that. Alito refused to affirm or announce his 1985 position that Roe versus Wade was wrongly decided. And then Schumer, some of which we'll hear, went in to a series of questions and statements designed to show that Clarence Thomas and Robert Bork also told the committee of their respect for precedent, but displayed contempt for it elsewhere, in Thomas's case sitting on the Supreme Court, Schumer said. And then Schumer gave examples from Alito's own decisions designed to show that Alito has less respect for precedent than most. Therefore, Schumer's conclusion, Alito's appointment would endanger Roe. And then this morning, about 45 minutes ago, Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois followed up on the Schumer line of questioning. So what we're going to do right now is play some excerpts from the Schumer-Alito questioning from yesterday, and then one excerpt from the Durbin-Alito exchange of this morning, and then do some analysis of it with a legal reporter from U.S. News & World Report. And then we'll go back live into the hearings in a little while. Okay, so let's start with about a minute and a half of the beginning of Senator Schumer's exchange with Judge Alito yesterday. This was the thing that a lot of people were waiting for, where he asks Alito point blank about what he wrote in 1985 regarding Roe.
Judge Alito, in 1985, you wrote that the Constitution, these are your words, does not protect a right to an abortion. And you said to Senator Specter a long time ago, I think it was about 9:30 this morning, 9:45, that those words accurately reflected your view at the time. Now let me ask you, do they accurately reflect your view today? Do you stand by that statement? Do you disavow it? Do you embrace it? It's okay if you distance yourself from it, and it's fine if you embrace it. We just want to know your view.
Senator, it was an accurate statement of my views at the time. That was in 1985. And I made it from my vantage point as an attorney in the Solicitor General's office. But it was an expression of what I thought at that time. If the issue were to come before me as a judge, if I'm confirmed, and if this issue were to come up, the first question that would have to be addressed is the question of stare decisis, which I've discussed earlier, and it's a very important doctrine, and that was the starting point and the ending point of the joint opinion in Casey. And then if I were to get beyond that, if the court were to get beyond the issue of stare decisis, then I would have to go through the whole judicial decision-making process before reaching a conclusion.
So, again, not a real answer to whether he still holds the analysis that he held in 1985, that abortion should not be protected by a correct reading of the Constitution. Obviously, he's emphasizing there that as a judge, as a justice sitting on the U.S. Supreme Court, he would have to also look at the importance of precedent and the history of various upholdings of the basis of Roe over time. So then Schumer went into a long line of questioning. It was really the most organized questioning of the whole day. I think a lot of the senators used the time, Democrat or Republican, to grandstand, to make speeches, and to flit from this point to that point to some other point. Schumer used his whole half hour in a very cogent way, and it's worth going back and listening to in full on the web if you're interested in this kind of thing. But he took step by step, first the exchange that we heard, and then his description of how Clarence Thomas and Robert Bork also told the committee of their respect for precedent, but in his opinion displayed contempt for it elsewhere. He described how even Justice Scalia has said that Thomas doesn't believe in stare decisis at all, even though he testified at his own confirmation hearings that he did. And then Schumer gave examples from Alito's own decisions as an appeals court judge designed to show that Alito has less respect for precedent than most, leading to Schumer's conclusion that his appointment would endanger Roe. So we're going to play now about 2 minutes of Schumer summing this whole thing up. And here he is.
Greatly disturbing, I think, to many Americans would be that you won't distance yourself from your 1985 view that the Constitution does not protect a right to a woman's right to choose, that that view has not changed, that you've refused to say, unlike you did in another part of that 1985 memo, that you think it's wrong now, which would lead one to think that you probably believe in it. Second, you've told us you respect precedent and stare decisis, but we have seen that the stated respect for stare decisis hardly determines whether a Supreme Court justice will vote to uphold precedents, not because when they come here they're being disingenuous with us, I don't think that at all, but because the concept is somewhat elastic, because it doesn't guarantee that you will uphold precedent, and particularly doesn't guarantee it when the Constitution conflicts with stare decisis, with the precedents of the court. And finally, to top it off, we have seen that your Third Circuit record can hardly provide a great deal of comfort in this area either, that many of your fellow judges criticized you for ignoring, abandoning, or overruling precedent. Taken together, these pieces are very disturbing to me. Your blanket 1985 statement, not distanced from, that the Constitution doesn't protect the right to an abortion. The fact that respect for precedent and stability doesn't prevent overruling of a past decision, and your own record of reversing or ignoring precedent on the Third Circuit lead to one inevitable conclusion. We can only conclude that if the question came before you, it is very likely that you would vote to overrule Roe v. Wade.
So kind of like a closing argument in a trial from Senator Schumer, wrapping up, tying all those pieces together from what we were discussing before. But if he thought that was going to be his last word, it wasn't, because Judge Alito, hoping to be Justice Alito, rather than just being quiet and yesing him and going on to the next Republican, wanted to respond to Senator Schumer. So they wound up going on for about another 2 minutes after that. And here's those 2 minutes.
My Third Circuit record in looking at abortion cases provides the best indication of my belief that it is my obligation to follow the law in this area and in all other areas. If I had had an agenda to uphold any abortion regulation that came along, I would not have voted as I did in my Third Circuit cases. Now, I've testified here today about what I think about stare decisis. I do think it's a very important legal doctrine, and I've explained the factors that figure into it. It would be the first question that I would consider if an issue like this came before me.
Let me just say, though, you have ruled on certain cases. Many of them were on technicalities. And in all of them, as a Third Circuit judge, you were bound by Supreme Court precedent. You never, in the Third Circuit, were squarely presented with the question that I asked, which is a decisive question, which is whether the Constitution protects a woman's right to choose. You were never asked in the court. You were never asked to overturn Roe v. Wade. And even if you were in the Third Circuit, you couldn't, because you were bound by the precedent of the court. I do not think your Third Circuit rulings are dispositive on what you would do should you become a U.S. Supreme Court justice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If the matter were to come up before me on the Supreme Court, I would consider the issue of stare decisis. And if the case got beyond that, I would go through that entire judicial decision-making process that I described. That's not a formality to me. That is the way in which I think a judge or a justice has to address legal issues. And I think that is very important. And I don't know a way to answer a question about how I would decide a constitutional question that might come up in the future other than to say I would go through that whole process. I don't agree with the idea that the Constitution always trumps stare decisis.
Doesn't always, but sometimes.
Let him finish his answer, Senator Schumer.
I don't agree with the theory that the Constitution always trumps stare decisis. There would be no need for there would be no room for the doctrine of stare decisis in constitutional law if that were the case.
But, sir, it can trump stare decisis. Doesn't always, but can. Is that correct?
It certainly can, and I think that's a good thing, because otherwise Plessy versus Ferguson would still be on the books.
Thank you.
So to my ear, and I didn't hear all of the testimony yesterday, but I heard a lot of it, that was about the most interesting thing that went on, the entire half hour involving Schumer and Alito and how they were tussling at the end there. And really, I guess Alito never really did say whether he leans more toward the Clarence Thomas view of stare decisis, that is to give precedent less weight and what he sees as the correct constitutional interpretation more weight, or leans more toward, say, Justice Breyer, whose name had come up earlier in the day, who said he just considers Roe settled law because there's enough stare decisis to establish that on this point. And I don't think anybody's going to get Alito to say that one way or another. But Dick Durbin, the Democratic whip, Democratic senator from Illinois, was the first questioner this morning. And about an hour ago, Durbin started his questioning by specifically following up on that line of discussion that we just heard between Schumer and Alito. So we're going to play an excerpt of that right now, and then we will discuss the whole question of abortion in these hearings with Liz Halloran, who covers the Supreme Court for U.S. News and World Report. This is 93.9 WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Brian Lehrer. A reminder that you can still hear uninterrupted gavel-to-gavel coverage. Right now, Judge Alito being questioned by Republican Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas on our AM station, AM 820. But for a little while longer, we'll be discussing what I think was the central tension in these hearings over the last day so far. So let's hear a few minutes of Senator Dick Durbin following up on that exchange with Schumer, questioning Judge Alito this morning.
I listened to you carefully yesterday address an issue which is very important to me, the Griswold case, because I think that it's a starting point for me when it comes to appointments to the Supreme Court. If I had any doubt in my mind that a Supreme Court nominee recognized the basic right of privacy of American citizens as articulated in Griswold, I couldn't support the nominee. And I listened as you explained that you supported that right of privacy and that you found the Griswold decision grounded in the Fifth Amendment, as well as the 11th Amendment. I'd ask you at this point, you obviously support Brown versus Board of Education, do you, and the finding of the court?
Certainly, Senator.
And do you believe that the Constitution protects the right of children in America to be educated in schools that are not segregated?
Absolutely, Senator. That was one of the greatest, if not the single greatest thing that the Supreme Court of the United States has ever done.
And as you read that Supreme Court decision, that historic decision, they find the basis for that decision, the Equal Protection Clause of our Constitution.
Yes, they did. And that was, I think, of course, we fought a civil war to get the 14th Amendment and to adopt the constitutional principle of equality for people of all races.
The reason I ask you about those two cases is that neither of those cases referred to explicit language in the Constitution. Those cases were based on concepts of equality and liberty within our Constitution. And the Griswold case took that concept of liberty and said it means privacy, though the word is not in our Constitution. And the Brown versus Board of Education case took the concept of equality, equal protection, and said that means public education will not be segregated. I raise that because I listened carefully as Senator Schumer asked you yesterday about Roe versus Wade. And I couldn't understand your conclusion. You conceded the fact that we have free speech because it's explicit in our Constitution, protected constitutional right. And yet, when Senator Schumer asked you repeatedly, do you find that Roe versus Wade established and recognized a constitutional protection for a woman to make this most private decision, you wouldn't answer. You wouldn't give a direct answer. On two Supreme Court cases, Griswold and Brown now, you have said, just right as we started this hearing, that you believe there is a constitutional basis for this protection and for this right. And yet when it came to Roe versus Wade, you would not. Most of us are troubled by this 1985 memo. You said yesterday you would have an open mind when it came to this issue. I'm sorry to report that your memo seeking a job in the Reagan administration does not evidence an open mind. It evidences a mind that sadly is closed in some areas. Yesterday when you were asked about one man, one vote, you clarified it, said those were my views then, they're not my views now. When Senator Cole asked you about the power and authority of elected branches as opposed to others, no, you said, I want to clarify, that's not my view now. And yet, when we have tried to press you on this critical statement that you made in that application, a statement which was made by you that said the Constitution does not protect a right to an abortion, you've been unwilling to distance yourself and to say that you disagree with that. I think this is critically important because, as far as I am concerned, Judge Alito, we have to rely on the Supreme Court to protect our rights and freedoms, especially our right to privacy. And for you to say that you're for Griswold, you accept the constitutional basis for Griswold, but you can't bring yourself to say there's a constitutional basis for the right of a woman's privacy when she is deciding, making a tragic, painful decision about continuing a pregnancy that may risk her health or her life. I'm troubled by that. Why can you say unequivocally that you find constitutional support for Griswold, unequivocally you find constitutional support for Brown, but cannot bring yourself to say that you find constitutional support for a woman's right to choose?
Brown versus Board of Education, as you pointed out, is based on the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment, of course, was adopted and ratified after the Civil War. It talks about equality. It talks about equal protection of the law. And the principle that was finally recognized in Brown versus Board of Education after nearly a century of misapplication of the 14th Amendment is that denying people the opportunity, people of a particular race, the opportunity to attend schools or, for that matter, to make use of other public facilities that are open to people of a different race denies them equality. They're not treated the same way. An African-American is not treated the same way as a black person when they're treated that way. So they're denied equality. And that is based squarely on the language of the Equal Protection Clause and the principle, the principle that was the magnificent principle that emerged from this great struggle that is embodied in the Equal Protection Clause. Griswold concerned the marital right to privacy, and when the decision was handed down, it was written by Justice Douglas, and he based that on his theories of his theory of emanations and penumbras from various constitutional provisions, the Ninth Amendment and the Fourth Amendment, and a variety of others. But it has been understood in later cases as based on the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, which says that no person shall be denied due process, shall be denied liberty without due process of law. And that's my understanding of it. And the issue that was involved in Griswold, the possession of contraceptives by married people, is not an issue that is likely to come before the courts again. It's not likely to come before the Third Circuit. It's not likely to come before the Supreme Court. So I feel an ability to comment, a greater ability to comment on that than I do on an issue that is involved in litigation. Now, what I have said about Roe is that if the issue were to come before me, if I'm confirmed and I'm on the Supreme Court and the issue comes up, the first step in the analysis for me would be the issue of stare decisis, and that would be very important. The things that I said in the 1985 memo were a true expression of my views at the time from my vantage point as an attorney in the Solicitor General's office, but that was 20 years ago, and a great deal has happened in the case law since then. Thornburg was decided, and then Webster, and then Casey, and a number of other decisions. So the stare decisis analysis would have to take account of that entire line of case law. And then if I got beyond that, I would approach the question, and of course in Casey that was the beginning and the ending point of the analysis and the joint opinion. If I were to get beyond that, I would approach that question the way I approach every legal issue that I approach as a judge, and that is to approach it with an open mind and to go through the whole judicial process, which is designed, and I believe strongly in it, to achieve good results, to achieve good decision-making.
Judge Sam Alito and his questioning earlier this morning by Democratic Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois. So Senator Durbin equating the Brown versus Board of Education decision, which he said went beyond the strict text of the Constitution, the Griswold decision on the right to privacy with respect to contraception, which laid the legal groundwork for Roe and Roe versus Wade. And as we heard Judge Alito say it there, he saw each differently. So what does this tell us about Alito's views today and how he might rule if given the chance to strike down Roe as wrongly decided under the Constitution? We'll talk about it with Liz Halloran, Supreme Court correspondent for U.S. News Report, U.S. News and World Report, in just a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we continue this morning to focus on the Samuel Alito confirmation hearings in the Senate Judiciary Committee. If you want to hear the hearings live, you can do so on our AM station, AM 820. Currently, Judge Alito still being questioned by Republican Sam Brownback, and I haven't been listening to it, but history from yesterday would indicate that the questioning by Republicans tends to be a lot of backslapping and softballing, and the questioning by Democrats tends to be confrontational. And so we're focusing here on the exchanges between Alito and some of the Democrats that may more elucidate what kind of a judge he's going to be, what kind of a justice he would be on the U.S. Supreme Court. And with us to help do that now is Liz Halloran. She covers the Supreme Court for U.S. News and World Report. Liz, thanks a lot for taking a few minutes out from the hearings yourself. Welcome to WNYC.
Out where Sam Brownback is indeed just finishing up questioning of Judge Alito.
And has it been the kind of softballing and backslapping that we saw from the other Republicans yesterday?
Well, as you probably know, Senator Brownback is a strong anti-abortion politician, and as occurred yesterday, there was a lot of speechifying, and he did talk about that to some degree. He just wrapped up some questions about the accommodation of religious expression in the public square. And now we will soon move on to Senator Coburn, and then the first round of questioning will end, and they'll move on to the second round.
Who's going to be the first questioner in the second round, the round of 20 minutes? Do you happen to know?
Well, they'll start again with the committee chairman, Arlen Specter, and the minority leader, Pat Leahy, and then they'll just trade off and go around. And from what I understand this morning from some Democratic sources, they're going to be asking for a third round. And Republicans are saying that if they do, Republican senators may pass on their time to more quickly move the hearings along.
What do Democrats think they would get out of Alito in a third round that they're not getting out of him in these first two?
That's a very good question, Brian. There's a little bit of head shaking going on about this potential request, and perhaps they'll think better of it. There seemed to be some paper shuffling yesterday when some of the Democratic senators were questioning Alito. They didn't seem to have clear lines of questioning, some of them, although Senator Schumer certainly added a little bit of drama to the day as the hours drew to a close. And as you mentioned before, Illinois Senator Dick Durbin quickly, as the first questioner this morning, followed up on Senator Schumer's
So let's talk about the issues that were raised and some of the questions and answers. And to me, I guess the central question in that whole half hour of boring in on him that Schumer did yesterday becomes, what is Justice Alito, or perhaps future Justice Alito's conception of stare decisis? Is he more like Justice Thomas, who really doesn't seem to give much weight to precedent at all if he thinks something was wrongly decided under the Constitution? Or is he more toward the other end of the spectrum? Because that's what's really crucial to know, it seems to me, if they're going to get a handle on how likely he is to actually vote to overturn Roe, since we know that he has believed in the past that it was wrongly decided under the Constitution.
Exactly, and that's just the line of questioning that Durbin pursued this morning. Again, he referred to that 1985 memo that then-Attorney Alito wrote in an attempt to get a job with the administration, and in that memo, of course, you know, he wrote that he does not see a constitutional protection for the right to abortion. Now, Senator Durbin asked under what conditions would he, because Judge Alito has not directly answered questions about how he feels about the Constitution protecting the right to abortion at this point in his life, Senator Durbin, as others have tried to push him on the issue of stare decisis. And Durbin actually this morning directly asked Judge Alito his definition of settled law or stare decisis. And his answer was interesting. He said, if settled means it can't be reexamined, that's one thing. If settled means it's subject to stare decisis and it's entitled to respect under stare decisis, but merits a judicial review, that's another thing. So he clearly is saying that settled law can be reexamined.
Right. And so what did you learn?
Not much more than yesterday, I would have to say. He certainly is keeping his options open on it, and frankly, his writings as a younger lawyer that perhaps Roe shouldn't be overturned, but should be hemmed in and limited by other efforts, other measures, perhaps is where his thinking still lies.
So let me ask you about Alito's record as you understand it, and I know you cover mostly the Supreme Court, so I don't know how much you've researched his record on the Third Circuit. But to read from the transcript of Schumer yesterday, he said, quote, "And finally, to top it off, we have seen that your Third Circuit record can hardly provide a great deal of comfort in this area either, that many of your fellow judges criticized you for ignoring, abandoning, or overruling precedent." And he had gone through a number of cases and really unfortunately didn't give Alito much of a chance to respond specifically to a number of cases from his own decisions on the Third Circuit that indicated to Schumer that he leans away from respect for precedent and therefore would be more likely than many other people to overturn Roe if he thought it was wrongly decided under the Constitution. Are you familiar enough as a legal correspondent with his Third Circuit record to place him somewhere on that spectrum of, you know, more respectful of precedent or less respectful of precedent in general?
Well, his decisions, while conservative, are somewhat mixed. And if you look at his decisions on the abortion question, he has a few of them from the Third Circuit, and a couple of them certainly, you know, paid respect to precedent. He did not allow he ruled against a couple that wanted to claim that some kind of illegal action based on the death of their fetus, ruling that a fetus is not under the Constitution recognized as a human being. And he also, but in the Casey case, obviously, he went beyond and tried to impose more limits on the availability of abortion to women, suggesting that they should have to notify their husbands, which was struck down. So he does respect precedent, but he tends to have a very conservative reading of precedent, and sometimes, as someone once described to me, he pushes the corners of that precedent to the most extreme part of the corner.
And we also had, or Schumer, I should say, had had listed a number of other cases that didn't have specifically to do with abortion, trying to make a generalized case that when it comes to precedent, yeah, Alito looks at precedent, but he's less likely than others to respect it if he thinks something is right or wrong under the law.
Or to feel bound by it.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
So, again, have you looked at that, and do you have a sense for where on that scale you would place him?
I have to say that his record is mixed. It's very conservative. He certainly reads precedent, but we'll push it to the conservative limit of the reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on the high court, if he's confirmed, I think there's probably little doubt that Roe-related cases will get a much more friendly hearing than they have with Justice O'Connor on the court.
And there was one point early yesterday where Alito made a point of saying that in two out of three cases, that there were three cases with respect to abortion that had come before him, and in two out of the three, he voted on the less restrictive side because he thought that's what the law required.
One was a partial birth abortion case where he followed the Supreme Court precedent where that disallowed states from banning the procedure, and the other case was the one that I mentioned where he did not allow a couple to proceed with a lawsuit based on the death of a fetus, and the third one was the Casey case, which he was on the other side with the spousal notification issue.
Now, we queued up the part of the Durbin questioning this morning that you were referring to before, because I think now this will be interesting.
The settled law issue.
The settled law issue, yes. So since you described that, I thought, and since it follows up so specifically on all this other stuff that we've been talking about, I thought we may take a couple of minutes now and play this stretch of questioning from earlier this morning. Again, Senator Richard Durbin with Judge Alito, and then we'll come back with Liz Halloran from U.S. News and World Report.
Well, and this is what troubles me, that you do not see Roe as a natural extension of Griswold, that you do not see the privacy rights of Griswold extended by the decision in Roe, that you decided to create categories of cases that are have been decided by the court that you will concede have constitutional protection, but you have left in question the future of Roe versus Wade. Yesterday, Senator Spector asked you, as he asked John Roberts before you, a series of questions about whether or not you accept the concept that this is somehow a precedent that we can rely on, that is embedded in our experience, that if it were changed, it would call into question the legitimacy of the court. And time again, he brought you to the edge, hoping that you would agree, and rarely, if ever, did you acknowledge that you would agree. You made in the most general statement that you believed reliance was part of stare decisis. But let me just ask you this. John Roberts said that Roe versus Wade is the settled law of the land. Do you believe it is the settled law of the land?
Roe versus Wade is an important precedent of the Supreme Court. It was decided in 1973, so it's been on the books for a long time. It has been challenged on a number of occasions, and I discussed those yesterday, and it is and the Supreme Court has reaffirmed the decision, sometimes on the merits, sometimes in Casey, based on stare decisis. And I think that when a decision is challenged and it is reaffirmed, that strengthens its value as stare decisis for at least two reasons. First of all, the more often a decision is reaffirmed, the more people tend to rely on it. And secondly, I think stare decisis reflects the view that there is wisdom embedded in decisions that have been made by prior justices who take the same oath and are scholars and are conscientious. And when they examine a question and they reach a conclusion, I think that's entitled to considerable respect. And, of course, the more times that happens, the more respect the decision is entitled to. And that's my view of that. So it's a very important precedent.
Is it the settled law of the land?
It is a precedent. If settled means that it can't be reexamined, then that's one thing. If settled means that it is a precedent that is entitled to respect as stare decisis, and all of the factors that I've mentioned come into play, including the reaffirmation and all of that, then it is a precedent that is protected, entitled to respect under the doctrine of stare decisis in that way.
How do you see it?
I've explained, Senator, as best I can, how I see it. It is a precedent that has now been on the books for several decades. It has been challenged. It has been reaffirmed. But it is an issue that is involved in litigation now at all levels. There is an abortion case before the Supreme Court this term. There are abortion cases in the lower courts. I've sat on three of them on the Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. I'm sure there are others in other courts of appeals or working their way toward the courts of appeals right now. So it's an issue that is involved in a considerable amount of litigation that is going on.
Judge Alito with Democratic Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois about an hour ago, and we're talking about this with Liz Halloran, who covers the Supreme Court for U.S. News and World Report. Liz, what did you think of the distinction that Durbin made between Alito's answer to the question of settled law and Judge Roberts' answers to the question of settled law? Do you think they were that different?
In essence, they weren't, although Roberts did not, you know, Roberts basically said Roe v. Wade is settled law and did not go into the long explanation that Judge Alito went into as to his definition of settled law. So they essentially said the same thing. We don't know Chief Justice Roberts' definition of settled law. It wasn't pursued as aggressively as Democrats have been pursuing Judge Alito on this issue. And it was certainly interesting that Judge Alito referred to this churning in the lower courts of abortion-related cases. The Supreme Court heard one earlier this year on parental notification out of New Hampshire. They are expected to take up a new partial birth abortion case this term. And it's just interesting to have him characterize the very real roiling that is occurring on this issue in lower courts.
Do you have any reason to believe, as a journalist, from what you've seen, that Roberts would have more respect for Roe as settled law than Alito, based on their hearings, or can we just not tell from what either of them have said?
It's very difficult to tell. There's so few, such a short term that Chief Justice Roberts served on the appeals court, and he demurred on many, many, many questions related to this when he was during his hearings. It's really very difficult to tell, although there are some who believe that Roberts may prove to be the more moderate conservative on the high court, particularly in his position as Chief Justice.
I know you have to go in a minute, and we're going to open up the phones. Any listener more supportive of Alito, less supportive of Alito, just listening with an open mind, as all the judge nominees say they do, be the umpire and call balls and strikes and tell us how you've been hearing all of this morning and yesterday. Our lines are now open at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 for your reaction to the Alito hearings thus far. But Liz, before you go, one last clip that we're going to play, and I want to get your comment on it, because I also thought this was extraordinary yesterday in Lindsey Graham's questioning, mm-hmm. where although most of it was softballs, like most of the Republicans have been doing, you know, Graham's a pretty compelling figure most of the time. And he actually asked Samuel Alito, as we will hear, if he thinks that 9/11 was a crime or an act of war. Did you happen to hear that moment?
Absolutely, yes.
What was Graham getting at?
Well, Graham was getting at this issue of the power of the president to, he was getting at the issue of the power of the president to invoke particular powers domestically during a time of war. And, you know, it probably links back to the scandal that the president finds himself in with the unwarranted surveillance that's been going on. But he
put Alito on the spot, because this question from a Republican was one that Alito didn't want to touch with a 10-foot pole either.
It was interesting because the back and forth with the rest of the Republicans, as you probably noticed and your listeners too, appeared very scripted, although under heavy questioning from Democratic Senator Feingold, Judge Alito swore that he was not prompted to answer particular questions in a certain way. But yes, when Senator Graham did go down that road, it was Judge Alito did appear a bit nonplussed at the line of questioning.
Liz Halloran covers the Supreme Court and is covering the Alito hearings for U.S. News and World Report. Thanks for coming on with us today, Liz. I appreciate
Thanks so
it
much,
a lot.
Ryan.
And here is a minute of that exchange between Senator Graham and Alito, in which he asks him about crimes versus acts of war.
We have laws on the book that protects us, the Fourth Amendment included, from our own law enforcement agencies coming against our own citizens. But we also have laws on the books during a time of war to protect our country from being infiltrated by foreign powers and bodies who wish to do harm to us. That's a totally different legal concept. Is that correct?
I'm reluctant to get into this because I think that things like act of war can well have particular legal meanings in particular contexts and, you know, under the Constitution.
Do you doubt that our nation has been in an armed conflict with terrorist organizations since 9/11, that we've been in an undeclared state of war?
In a lay sense, certainly we have been in a conflict with terrorist organizations. I'm just concerned that in the law, all these phrases can have particular meanings that are defined by the cases.
That's-